From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a local eyewitness of the testing 65 years ago this month of the first atomic bomb. Also, Rock and Roll Eye, a Sacramento photographer, shows some of his pictures of famous musicians, and a book about Hmong cuisine and life in America. First, when Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson lost a strong mayor council vote recently, you might have thought that was the end of the issue, at least for now. The council had voted 7-2 against drafting language for a strong mayor ballot measure. But Johnson wasn't ready to give up, and he recruited two top local attorneys to do the drafting instead. The two attorneys were Leanne Randolph, a lawyer with expertise in political law, and Clark Kelso, professor at McGeorge School of Law and frequent go-to guy for politicians and government seeking help. I asked Kelso how he got involved in drafting the strong mayor ballot measure.
Well, the mayor tracked me down on vacation. I was actually down in Orlando with my family, enjoying a week off, and he tracked me down and in a brief phone call, asked me whether this was a project that I thought I could take on, be worthwhile. And I said, sure, I think this is an important topic and one that I'm happy to come in and provide some help on.
Leon Randolph, another attorney, is also involved in this. How did she get involved?
Well, she was involved, I think, a little bit before me, not much, obviously, but my understanding was that one of her partners had a conversation with the mayor and indicated that Leanne had the right type of technical expertise and lawyerly background to assist in some drafting, and that and she agreed that she'd like to provide some of her time as well.
How did you and Leanne Randolph decide what powers to propose giving the mayor and the city council? Was that up to you? Did Mayor Johnson give you direction?
That was easy. We didn't want to try to make a judgment about exactly what form an executive mayor proposal should take. And over the course of the last 18 months, as this discussion has occurred, the mayor has gotten more and more specific about precisely what powers he thinks should be part of the package. And he had presented to the city council something called the Accountability Plan of 2010 a few months ago that actually has been analyzed by the city attorney and by others. And there's essentially we had a one-page list of powers that were part of that. And they're similar to powers that you find in executive mayor charters for other cities, San Diego, San Francisco, Fresno. So we actually had pretty specific guidance about what to draft.
So you and Leanne Randolph did not add or subtract any powers. You just basically put into a legal format the proposal that was already out there.
Exactly right. We put it into specific language that would implement the general powers that were described as part of the mayor's accountability plan. And that's an important step when you're in a legislative drafting process, because there's a big difference between having general concepts and actually having specific language that tries to implement them. The specific language, once you have that, then proponents and opponents can take a close look at, does this actually implement what we intended to do? Are there problems with the drafting? So it's an important step to take in the democratic process.
My guest is Clark Kelso, McGeorge Law School professor. He and attorney Leon Randolph recently drafted a proposed ballot measure that would give the city of Sacramento a so-called strong mayor or executive mayor, and the measure was drafted at the request of Mayor Kevin Johnson. Were you concerned about getting involved in an issue that's become so controversial?
Not really. I've been doing precisely this type of work in taking on sort of controversial tasks for about 15 or 20 years. It's simply part of my personal public service. I've been able to do this in my role as an academic. I have the freedom to do this without having to represent anybody. And so I don't have any reticence about getting involved in matters that are controversial. I do think it's an important topic. The mayor essentially was elected as a change agent for the city. And this is one of the main things that I think the mayor can propose that would effectuate the type of structural change that he has sought as part of his whole candidacy for the position.
You said that the proposed changes in Sacramento are similar to the powers that are given to the mayor and the city council and the city managers in other cities that have a strong mayor or executive mayor. But I'm looking at a checklist of comparing Sacramento now and proposed along with other cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Fresno that have a strong mayor. And there are quite a lot of differences, subtle differences maybe in some cases. Mm-hmm. Did you agree with all of the proposed rights and responsibilities that would be given to Sacramento mayor and city council?
Well, you're exactly right. There are differences in details, although as the city attorney, I think, concluded overall, this is pretty similar to the powers of other executive mayors. And to answer your question specifically, no. I didn't want to get involved in trying to make judgments about what the proposal should look like. In my opinion, that's an issue to be decided ultimately by the voters. They're the ones, once something gets on the ballot ultimately, they're the ones who should have the right to decide exactly what that balance of powers should be.
If it goes on the ballot, it would be because the city council put it there, and ultimately they can decide what will go on the ballot. What would you say if the Sacramento City Council puts the measure on the ballot, but only after making significant changes to the draft that you helped write?
Oh, that's perfectly fine. Leanne and I don't have that type of pride of authorship over this draft. And we certainly agree that the best people to make a final judgment about what would go on the ballot really are the mayor, the city council, the city attorney, the constitutional officers of the city, the charter officers. They're the ones who can take that final look and decide what works and what doesn't work for the city of Sacramento.
My guest is Clark Kelso. There was a quote by Mayor Johnson in the Sacramento Bee when this all came out, became publicly known, and he was quoted as saying, "These are two of the top lawyers in the state," referring to you and Leanne Randolph. The quote goes on, "They're not necessarily part of the plan," and that's apparently referring to the charter overhaul. Assuming that quote is accurate, it seems ambiguous. Are you and Leanne Randolph involved in the proposed charter changes beyond the work that you've done in the last couple of weeks?
Oh, not at all. I haven't been involved at all in formulating any of the prior proposals. I've taken no position on the prior proposals. I don't take a for or opposed position on this proposal. And actually, that's something that I've done for the last 15, 20 years with the state legislature. When I do this type of work, which I really think of as technical assistance, I very deliberately don't take a position pro or con the merits. I don't want to get involved in that discussion. That's for other people. The role that Leanne and I took was a technical one to try to provide the city council and the people of Sacramento with a detailed draft that they could consider.
Well, I think you've already dealt with the question I was about to ask you, which is, do you personally have a position on the strong mayor issue?
I don't have a position on it one way or the other. It's, I think it's accurate to say that the mayor ran on a change platform and that this was a key element of that. And it does seem to me that the voters should get a chance to take a look at charter reform and make a decision. Do we want to go in this direction or don't we? I do think that's an important for the voters to have that opportunity.
Clark Kelso, McGeorge Law School professor. He and attorney Leanne Randolph recently drafted a proposed ballot measure that would give Sacramento a so-called strong mayor, and that was done at the request of Mayor Kevin Johnson. On a separate matter, if I may, you also have special responsibilities for California's prison healthcare system. Last year, the governor sued to remove you as receiver, but an appeals court denied that a couple of months ago, saying California needs a powerful receiver to ensure that big reforms happen. But the reality is California is in a very deep financial hole. Even with the powers the federal court has given you as receiver, what are you able to do to fix the prison healthcare system?
Well, on prison health care, we're making a great deal of progress precisely because we've worked well with the legislature and except for one dispute with the governor over a construction budget that we've now resolved, we've been able to get support from the legislature, from the governor, from his Secretary of Corrections, Matt Cate, to make the changes that are necessary. And, for example, the rate of deaths resulting from lack of access to care, those are down 70% to 80% over the last 3 years. We're making very steady progress with the resources available to us.
So from your point of view, it seems that relations have improved now between your office and the governor.
Very dramatically. We got involved in litigation against each other. I filed the first volley, and I think in retrospect it was a mistake. We got in litigation over who has authority to order construction of new facilities. And ultimately what's happened is the litigation has sort of gone away. Secretary Matt Cate and I came to an agreement about how to do construction, and we're moving forward with that agreement. The legislature has approved the construction plans this year that we have, and we're moving forward. So the dispute we had last year really has gone away.
But where will the money come from for all this? Because there's about a $19 billion rolling hole in the state budget, and I've heard on more than one occasion experts saying that California should be very wary of taking on any more debt.
Sure. The money for the construction actually was previously appropriated back in 2007. So we don't require any new funds for the construction that we've agreed on. And this year, the governor for the operational budget of prison health care, he proposed basically a 40% reduction in our budget, about $800 million, that I have agreed with and that the legislature has enacted. We've taken very strong steps in the last year to reduce what had been very rapidly rising health care costs in the prisons. We're actually now reducing the cost of health care in the prisons, and I think we're on the right track.
But how can you improve the quality of health care offered in the prison system while simultaneously spending less on the operation?
Well, that's because we're putting in place management controls that previously simply did not exist in corrections health care. The most important one is something called utilization management, where, and this is something that HMOs around the country do, where instead of simply letting every individual doctor decide what's the next path for treatment, we actually have a set of detailed protocols and standards-based guides where you have to consult those guides before you can take the next expensive step. And it's reduced our expenses 30 to 40%.
Sounds like the kind of thing that might work in prison, but would be very politicized if it were translated to outside of prisons. At least in California.
We are able to do some things in controlling health care in the prisons that, you're exactly right, would be problematic if you did them outside the prisons.
And on the similar matter, earlier this year, you called for medical parole for comatose and other severely incapacitated inmates. There is a bill that Senator Mark Leno wrote. You supported. Where does that bill stand?
Well, we passed the Senate and passed the Public Safety Committee in the Assembly, and it's scheduled to be heard next in the Appropriations Committee in the Assembly. And I think they will pass it, because this is a way of achieving some very important savings. What we're trying to do is isolate the top 50 or so most expensive inmates whose medical condition renders them completely harmless, people in comas, where we're having to spend an enormous amount of money right now because we're responsible for the full costs of care.
And guarding them.
Two guards, 24/7.
In case that comatose guy runs away and kills someone.
And it's a comatose guy who's chained to the bed. So we just think that we can much more cost-effectively provide treatment if that person is on something called medical parole. If they recover miraculously, they'll come off of medical parole and go back into the institution. But we save on guarding costs, and most importantly, when you're on parole, most of these inmates will be able to qualify for federal assistance for their health care. So it's a big win for the state in terms of reducing costs.
I read these astonishing numbers that $213 million could be saved over 5 years by medically paroling just 32 inmates. That's crazy.
Well, it's the reality. And it actually is, you know, what you do get in almost all public health care programs. That little, you know, 99% of the people don't cost you very much. It's that last percent, many of them at end of life, where you're doing end of life treatment for 1, 2, or 3 years. That's where we burn through, in our case, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Clark Kelso, McGeorge Law School professor, also federal receiver for California's prison healthcare system. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a local veteran of the Manhattan Project recalls the building and testing of the first atomic bomb. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Carlson. 65 years ago this month, the world's first atomic bomb was tested in New Mexico. It was a key moment for the Manhattan Project, the secret effort by the U.S. and its allies to build a nuclear weapon. A few weeks later, two bombs were dropped on Japan, and the Second World War ended soon after. One of the young scientists working on the Manhattan Project was John Youngerman. He went on to work at UC Davis, where he became a professor of physics and the first director of the campus's Crocker Nuclear Laboratory. He joins us by phone. John Youngerman, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
How did you get involved in the Manhattan Project? Did you volunteer? Were you assigned to it?
Well, I was teaching in Naval ROTC in Berkeley in the physics department, you know, helping people to be ensigns after 3 months of physics and other things. And I did that for a year, and then you have to understand in those days everybody wanted to do the utmost for the war effort, and I decided that wasn't enough, so I contacted my department chair, R.T. Burge, and said, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to join the Navy. And he says, what do you want to do that for? Go work for Lawrence. And what's he doing? Never mind. And that was the Manhattan Project. I, being a dutiful graduate student, joined the Manhattan Project.
When he said, never mind, did you have some inkling of what was going on?
No, none at all. I just, it obviously was something secret, and he wasn't going to tell me anything.
When you started work on the Manhattan Project, how much were you told about what was really going on?
Very little, because I worked on electromagnetic separation at Berkeley and Oak Ridge, and there the security was very heavily compartmentalized, and they told you the minimum.
Did you guess what was going on?
Yeah, because we got a scuttlebutt with my graduate student friends who were also working there. We kind of figured it out, but it was quite different. Los Alamos, when I arrived there, the first thing they did was give me a primer and explain the whole project. And then Oppenheimer had this open kind of policy where they have a colloquium once a week where all the technical people would meet, and I even got in there as a technical graduate student and could hear all the big shots discuss the problem. So it was quite different.
Oppenheimer being Robert Oppenheimer, the scientific director of the Manhattan Project, it sounds like you were a little surprised about how much you were told about the real nature of the project at Los Alamos. Was it becoming pretty widely known what was really being done there, i.e. developing an atomic bomb?
Well, I don't know what you mean by widely known. It was
by the public.
Not by the public, no, not at all.
What kind of things were you told to not talk about it outside of your work environment?
Well, you just were or told that your letters were going to be censored, and your address was box for such and such Santa Fe, New Mexico, and that was it. There wasn't any communication with the outside world. That was certainly a no-no.
Did you talk about what you knew with anyone?
No, not well. With my buddies inside the project, but nobody outside, no.
Yeah. My guest is John Youngerman. He's a professor emeritus of physics at UC Davis. In the Second World War, he was a young scientist working on the Manhattan Project. What exactly were you doing in the project?
Well, when I arrived at Los Alamos, there was kind of a crisis because the plutonium which was being produced at Hanford, was going to be unsatisfactory as a material for the technique they used with the uranium-235, which had been made at Oak Ridge. There you take a naval cannon and shoot a shell into an annular ring and make a critical mass, but you can't do that with plutonium because it has a high spontaneous fission rate. It was discovered, and that means by the time the pieces get together, even though we're talking about a thousandth of a second, it could start a nuclear chain reaction prematurely, and you'd get a fissile or unpredictable yield. So plutonium can't be used in a naval gun kind of design. And so then the question was, well, what can we do with this new material, which we spent billions of dollars creating? And then they came up at Los Alamos with the idea of implosion, where you surround the plutonium sphere with a lot of high explosive, and you fire it all off in a millionth of a second and create a spherical shock wave which condenses the plutonium to maybe double normal density, and then you get a critical mass. So that was the theory, but, you know, if the explosion didn't happen symmetrically, it just pushed the plutonium to one side. You can imagine it not working. So
yes,
that was the project's problem when I arrived.
You were working, of course, on a nuclear weapon that would have the ability to kill tens, even hundreds of thousands of people. Of course, the goal was to try and end the Second World War to the benefit of the U.S. and its allies. How much did you think about what this bomb would be capable of doing? And did that weigh on you at all?
Well, a little bit. I saw the first nuclear explosion in Los Alamos in the Alamogordo Desert, and after we witnessed that, we all kind of felt a lot of pity for the Japanese because we knew it would be used on them. But you have to understand, in the context of World War II, Curtis LeMay had bombed Tokyo for several days and killed 80,000 people. So that was acceptable to bomb cities. And the difference here was that one bomb destroyed one city, which is quite a different order of magnitude of violence.
You said that you witnessed the explosion of the first atomic bomb at Los Alamos. Tell us about what that looked and sounded like.
Well, we were on a cinder cone there in Alamogordo, about 50 miles south of Albuquerque, and it was a pre-dawn kind of darkness, just beginning to light up the new day. And then this awesome, brilliant light happened, and it was brighter than day all of a sudden, and I instinctively turned my gaze away from it. And there was a cloud began to form and purple flashes in it, and the mushroom cloud was forming, and we knew that that had a lot of nasty material in there, unexploded plutonium, which is not very good for you. 1 microgram can cause lung cancer, and there are kilograms of unexploded material in the bomb, plus all the fission products. So we had gone in unauthorized and slept out overnight on a cinder cone, and we decided to get out of there.
Oh, my goodness. Did you wonder if you had maybe suffered ill health effects?
No, not at all. When you're 20 or so, you're indestructible, you know.
Yeah, of course. So it was just a few weeks later that bombs were dropped on Japan, and the war ended soon after. How did you feel about that?
Well, we felt that was the first one. I thought was, you know, that's what we've been working for. We're trying to end the war and teach the Japanese that you don't need to attack us again. But then when the second bomb was announced over the loudspeakers at Los Alamos, I told myself, gee, what did they do that for? And then it occurred to me that we technical types didn't have anything to say about it. It was really up to the politicians and the military what they're going to do with this new weapon.
Would you have been surprised if you'd learned then that those would be the only two bombs that would be exploded? Here we are in 2010, it's 65 years later, and they're still the only bombs that have been exploded in war.
Well, I guess I might have been surprised, although that was our hope, that people would realize that war was still was not a nuclear war is not an option. It's something that just destroys civilizations, and no war with nuclear weapons is worth doing. So that's a lot of us who knew the effects of nuclear weapons were trying to tell the public about in subsequent years. And fortunately, we had a lot of good politicians like President Kennedy, who kept the Air Force from bombing Cuba during the Cuba Missile Crisis. And it turned out the Russians had missiles with nuclear weapons ready to go in Cuba. They could have released those with such an attack and taken out Washington or New York or something. So it was a very close thing, and I think we've been awfully lucky, actually. So I think that's the thing we ought to do, is try to get rid of nuclear weapons in the world completely. That's Obama's stance these days, and I think it's a wonderful idea.
John Youngerman, his lecture, Memories of the Manhattan Project, will be shown on Davis Community Television. That's cable channel 15 in Davis today at 1 p.m. He's professor emeritus of physics at UC Davis. He was a young scientist working on the Manhattan Project at the end of the Second World War. John Youngerman, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a Sacramento rock music photographer who's showing some of his favorite pictures. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Monday, we'll look at another proposed development for Sacramento's K Street, one that would create a year-round marketplace. Some familiar faces can be seen at the Sacramento Rock and Radio Museum at tomorrow night's Second Saturday. Those faces include Tom Petty, Kurt Cobain, Muddy Waters, and Sid Vicious. They're all in photographs taken by Sacramento rock music photographer Greg Savlin. Many of the pictures were taken in Sacramento and Davis. He's in our studio. Greg Savlin, welcome to Inside.
How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing well. How did you get started photographing rock musicians?
Well, you know, it started a long time ago. I used to go to a lot of shows, and I guess it was one way of remembering them, you know, the next day, seeing them.
It started out as a hobby?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it was just fun, you know, we were doing the shows. We used to go to Winterland and, you know, San Francisco, a group of us all the time.
Were you allowed to take those photographs?
Oh, yeah, and that was, yeah. Back then, they let you bring your camera in.
Yeah. And so. Do you remember who was the first person you took a photograph of? Long time ago.
Oh, yeah, well, could have been like in the Johnny Winter days, Mott the Hoople. I mean, could have been Johnny Winter.
Yeah, Johnny Winter. Mott the Hoople being a sort of British glam rock band.
Yeah, with the Ian Hunter. Bowie.
Yeah. By the way, there are a couple of Greg's photographs on our website, capradio.org/insight. They're pretty dramatic photographs. Let's talk about one of them. And if you're at our website, you can click on it and see it. It's a photograph of Iggy Pop. Yeah. Tell us when you took this picture and where.
Okay, that was at the old Waldorf in San Francisco. And I was like right up front. It's like a little club. I mean, you wouldn't know it, but I was damn near getting killed. It was, he grabbed me by the hair, and I sang I Just Want to Be Your Dog. We sang that together. And I actually was looking over at the speakers, and I was hearing my voice come out. I couldn't believe it.
Iggy Pop grabbed you by the hair?
Yeah, we sang I Just Want to Be Your Dog.
Wow. It's a pretty intense-looking photograph. His eyes look are very wide open and almost kind of crazy-looking.
Yeah, that's Iggy. I mean, well, we were like, they had these little chairs and tables, and all the chairs in the whole place ended up in the back of the corner. People took all the chairs except for the two that we were sitting in the front. We were the last people up front holding our table.
My guest is Greg Savlin, photographer. An exhibit of photographs he's taken of famous rock musicians performing on stage is being shown at the Sacramento Rock and Radio Museum. It's in Midtown Sacramento. You can see it tomorrow in Second Saturday. Another one of the musicians that you took a photograph of, and this picture's on display, is Sid Vicious of the Sex Pistols. And this was taken at a significant Sex Pistols concert, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the last one at Winterland, San Francisco. Yeah, that was intense. I was I was kind of like a long hair, you know, rocker. I mean, and I was in the middle of a war, It was a rough night. It was like raining outside. Everything in the world was hitting the stage. They were throwing everything in the world, from money to umbrellas, you name it, oranges. Things were hitting the stage left, right, and left.
And the band was self-destructing at that time.
Oh, yeah. But, Sid was Sid. I mean, he was actually, if he had a sense of humor, you should have seen it. He was taunting the crowd and spitting at them, and everybody's trying to get him, and he was just having the time of his life.
It hardly looks like he's even playing his bass guitar. It's like held about a yard away from his body. He's stripped to the waist. He's got what looks like leather pants on. He wasn't really the greatest bass guitarist. He was more of a showman.
Oh, yeah. During that shot, he was doing the pogo. That's where that all started. He was like, because he slipped, fell on the ground. He was playing on his back, But I don't even know if the thing was hooked up. Back then, that's what they were saying.
Well, both the pictures we've talked about that are on our website, capradio.org/insight, you were basically physically accosted.
Yeah, it was pretty tough. I almost was in shock after that show. I didn't go see a show for about 3 or 4 months after that. It was that intense, as far as being up front. But it was a party, though. I had $4. $4 for the seats.
Really?
I mean, that's how much it cost for concerts back then.
Wow, you pay more for that to see some coffee shop shows now in Sacramento. There's quite a lineup of musicians, everything from the Ramones to Pink Floyd, that are in this photo exhibit. What's your favorite band or musician that's exhibited?
Ramones are one of my favorites, and Iggy is one of my favorites. Iggy's one of my mainstays, but I don't know. Like, again, I go into the Johnny Winters, and there's a bunch of them in there. I don't have my list in front of me, but...
So your musical tastes tended more towards the hardcore rock and blues, that sort of thing.
At time, and then I started working with papers, newspapers, so I started doing... I did country and all kinds. They made me do all kinds of stuff. And next thing you know, I started shooting Merle Haggard, and, I spent 4 days on tour with Hank Jr.,
yeah,
stuff like that, and Van Halen, stuff like that.
When I look over the list of musicians and bands, a lot of them are dead now. Are you surprised when you look at this and think how many of those people you photographed are dead? Like Sid Vicious.
Yeah, well, not really. I mean, I'm surprised I'm still here.
What do you mean?
Well, it's been a long trip. I mean, it's I used to play water polo and swim and stuff, so I used to take it to the limit a lot of these shows, because every show was another show.
Many of these pictures were taken at venues in Sacramento and Davis, like Freeborn Hall in Davis. Let's see, what else? The Veterans Memorial Hall in Davis, Crest Theater in Sacramento. A lot of these places are still around. What was your favorite place to go to?
Well, there's a place in the... on set called Slick Willie's. It was a good... That's where I shot the Ramones, at Slick Willie's. But, the Crest was good. Club Can't Tell was an opportunity for me to shoot a lot of shows there, because we did a lot of the stuff. I used to hang out with, bands like True West and Cactus Liquors. And, we had a group of people. We had, a scene back then. Things happened.
And finally, Greg, when you go to a rock concert to take photographs, is there a particular spot that you always go to, because it usually is the best place to be?
Well, it's not as easy to shoot these days, but, I used to work. Let's say Ted Nugent. You know where Ted Nugent is. You either work on one side or the other side. But, it's like anything. In the old days, you had to work your way up to the front. So I used to always work my way off to the side and then work my way across into people to get in, because you just can't go straight through the crowd. You had to work your way. Sometimes it took time. But, it was all good at the end.
No doubt. Great pictures. Greg Savlin's exhibit of photographs he's taken of famous rock musicians performing on stage is being shown at the Sacramento Rock and Radio Museum. That's 907 20th Street. You can see it tomorrow night at Second Saturday, and it's going to be there, I believe, for a couple of months. Greg Savlin, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a book about Hmong cuisine and life in America. The authors include a Hmong woman who lives in Elk Grove. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download our show at capradio.org/insight. Cooking from the Heart is a book about Hmong cuisine and Hmong life in America. The authors are two women, one Hmong, one from Oregon, with a long and deep relationship. Sheng Yang was born in Laos and came to America when she was a child. In Oregon, she met teacher Sammy Scripter, and they clicked. Sammy was even like a mother to Sheng. Some 30 years on, they're still friends, even though Sheng now lives in Elk Grove and Sammy's still in Portland. When they joined us in Insight last year, I asked Sheng Yang how she came to America.
Well, we come in because the communists took over their country. So we come like everybody else. We immigrate into the Thailand camps and then to the United States, immigrant to the United States.
How old were you when you moved to America?
I was about 9 when I came in.
You're about 9. And how aware were you of what was going on in your life and where you were going and why you were going there?
Well, my parents told us that it's a better country for us and it were help us educate better.
And were you okay with what you were doing?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you were in Oregon.
Yes.
And you met Sammy. How did you meet Sammy?
Well, Sammy actually worked at the school that I went, and that's how we met. And we became friends ever since that day.
Sammy, what was your job at that time?
I was actually coordinating the Talented and Gifted program in the school. I was no one's teacher. The school was so crowded with this influx of Hmong students that there was no room for me in a regular office. So my office, my little desk, was in the corner of the ESL room. And I just met Sheng and all of the Hmong students very casually that way.
What was your impression of Sheng when you met her?
That she was a very sober, curious young woman. Hardly a child anymore in her own culture. She had a lot of questions for me. She wanted to learn to play the guitar, and I helped find someone that would teach her.
And this was a couple of years after she'd arrived, wasn't it?
It was about a year and a half after her family had arrived in the United States.
I see. Sheng, did you speak English before you came to the United States?
No, I do not.
And how quickly did you learn?
Well, English was tough. I think English was all the language that hardest to learn. And
but you were in the gifted program, I guess.
Yes.
Yes. Very good. So, Sammy, tell us about how the friendship developed between you and Sheng.
Well, it was so long ago, we don't always remember the details accurately. But Sheng and I began talking. She would show me pictures she'd drawn. And so I began knowing her. One of her brothers is my son's age. And Sheng herself is my daughter's age. And so the children played back and forth. I'd return the kids home to their family and would always be invited into Sheng's house by her mom and offered food and drink. And that was just a wonderful thing because it was food I'd never eaten before. And her family gardened. I had about a half an acre and we all gardened together. So our family just grew to be friends over time.
How much did you know about Hmong life before meeting Sheng?
I knew nothing. I didn't know what Hmong people were until all these energetic, interesting Asian children arrived in our school. I knew nothing. And then I began to read and learn a little bit and, of course, just getting to know the people.
Sheng, what did your parents make of Sammy and the other Americans that you were spending a lot of time with?
Well, I think my parents think it's great that they want to be friends with us. You know, to know all the culture and all the people is just a wonderful thing. My father was a minister, so we always moved from place to place, and getting to know all the people in Hmong is just a wonderful.
So they welcomed Sammy's influence on your
yes.
life. They did. Huh. Very good. My guests are Sheng Yang and Sammy Scripter, the co-authors of Cooking from the Heart, The Hmong Kitchen in America. Sheng is a Hmong woman. She was born in Laos, came to America. In Oregon, she met Sammy, who is a retired educator. And they've stayed friends for the 30 years or so since they first met. Sammy, describe to us how Hmong cuisine tasted to you when you first encountered it.
Oh, well, It looked very different than anything I'd had. We had a lot of Vietnamese people in Portland, so I'd eaten Vietnamese food, but it isn't like Vietnamese food. It's very simple, and they cook a lot of soups, a lot of vegetables, and I think the things that I was struck by initially were the marvelous combination of flavors that they use in most of their cooking, and especially in a dish they called kuatao, which is a hot chili condiment. It's got the most wonderful exploding flavor you can ever imagine. It was very different than anything I'd had before.
Sheng, you've lived in America now for about 30 years. When you eat at home, what do you eat? Do you eat Hmong food, or do you eat more commonly eaten American food, or a mixture?
I think we do a mixture.
Yeah. How did the idea for the book come about?
Well, it was gradual. I think it probably started with my curiosity, because I'm not very good with languages. And one way I found you can get to know people that are not like yourself is to cook with them and to share cooking practices. And Sheng's family was very friendly. Her mother really quickly picked up on this. And so we did a lot of cooking together, and I began writing down what they were showing me, because the Hmong never had written any recipes down.
Did they know you were doing that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And it wasn't important to Sheng's mother, because, of course, they knew how to cook without written recipes, but it was important to me, and so they were helping me, and so they were helping me make sure that I understood what herbs were involved and how much water you use to cook the rice. And so I began writing them down from the very beginning. And gradually over the years, we began talking about writing a book. It was just a gradual progression to the place where we started really being concrete about what chapters we wanted.
But listening to you talking about cooking, about how you thought it was a good way to get to know these people, and your interest in writing down the recipes and really learning it, it sounds like that was something that was really important to you in general, cooking, was it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I love to cook. I think cooking to me is not so much about the expertise, but it's about sharing food with friends and family. It's about the experience of sitting down and eating together. That's a very it's a very good way to get to know other people. And I'm not an expert chef, but I love to cook, and I love to feed other people. And, you know, that's kind of the way the Hmong culture is. Food is a celebratory thing for them, and they're very generous sharing food with others.
Well, obviously we need to eat to live, but Sheng, tell us a little bit more about that, about the role of food in Hmong life and Hmong culture and the role of eating.
Well, Hmong people, food always played the center of our friendship between us and others. And if we have a visitor coming, doesn't matter who it is, food always be a part of the visiting.
Sure.
Yeah, and food play a big role in our Hmong community.
Well, we'd love to hear a bit from the book Cooking from the Heart, The Hmong Kitchen in America. And Sammy, you're going to read from the introduction to the chapter about vegetables and herbs.
I'll do that. Vegetables and herbs, and pardon my Hmong pronunciation, but in Hmong it's Zhao Tia Tua Jua. That's vegetables and herbs. Vegetables are the soul of Hmong cuisine. Hmong cooks use a fabulous variety. Leafy greens of all kinds, squashes, melons, pods, shoots, tendrils, tubers, mushrooms, roots, and seeds. Only fresh, good-looking vegetables appear in Hmong dishes. Menus are often decided upon by which vegetables are available and in their prime. In Laos, Hmong families raised all of their own vegetables. In America, many Hmong families make a living by growing, harvesting, and selling vegetables at farmers' markets. So strong is the desire to be connected to the land and growing things that even Hmong professionals make space for a backyard garden. At first glance, to a non-Hmong, the Hmong garden may appear haphazard, with cucumbers and beans vining up mismatched branches stuck into the ground and unidentified weeds growing among the more cultivated crops. But on closer inspection, everything makes sense. The rough bark of the branches is a perfect surface for vines to take hold and climb. And what others may consider a weed is given space in a Hmong garden because of its medicinal properties. Hmong gardeners have a deep understanding of plants, and they work with nature to obtain bountiful organic harvests. Just as fat pork on the table is a symbol of wealth and prosperity, vegetables, even though they are much loved, are a symbol of being poor. Marriage feasts do not include vegetables because their presence would be an omen of a poor life for the married couple. Vegetables are not served at funerals either because the Hmong desire a rich afterlife for the deceased. At all other meals, vegetables and herbs play a major role.
That's Sammy Scripter, reading from the book Cooking from the Heart, The Hmong Kitchen in America. She's co-author of the book with Sheng Yang, who is a Hmong woman. That's very interesting, that bit there about vegetables being an omen of poverty. Sheng, does that still carry on today?
Yes, it is.
I see. Earlier, Sammy talked about gardening, and I'm aware of the fact that gardening is an important part of Hmong culture. Are people able to grow here in the Sacramento area the things that they would have grown at home?
Yes.
Yeah. Like what? What would be the most common vegetables?
Well, I would say we call it the chicken's herb. That's what we usually grow in our backyard.
Chicken's herb?
Chicken's herb.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Sammy, how often do you cook Hmong food when you're home?
Well, when I was writing the cookbook, I think we had it every day. I don't cook it every day anymore. There's a few dishes that my husband loves especially. The larb, which is a Laotian meat salad with herbs. I love to make kapung when I have a gathering because it's a soup that you can serve a lot of people. So, and I'm often asked to cook Hmong because people know I wrote the cookbook. So I probably cook Hmong a couple times a week.
Earlier, you apologized in advance for your pronunciation of Hmong, but to my uneducated ear, it sounds pretty good. Sheng, how does she speak? How does she pronounce the words?
Well, I think Sammy do really well.
Because she
had do really well in Hmong pronunciation. So
very good. And Sammy, are there still a lot of Hmong people in Oregon?
There aren't as many as when Sheng first moved to Oregon. The various helping organizations that relocated the Hmong people brought a lot of them to Oregon to begin with. But then, as it was the case during that time, families that were split apart by our relocation then moved together. And a lot of the Hmong moved from Portland to Sacramento and Minneapolis-St. Paul. There's currently about 4,000 Hmong people in the Portland area.
Well, thank you so much. That's Sammy Scripter, along with Sheng Yang. They're co-authors of Cooking from the Heart, The Hmong Kitchen in America. Sammy is a retired educator who lives in Portland, Oregon, where she met Sheng, who was born in Laos. And Sheng was a child when she met Sammy in Oregon. Sheng now lives in Sacramento. Thank you both so much for joining us, Sheng and Sammy.
Thank you for having us.
And that's Insight for this week. Insight's theme was written by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producer was Lynn Weaver, and today's engineer was Mohammed Mirpour. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, the senior producer is Jen Picard, and the executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us. Cells from fat help heal bone? Researchers at UC Davis are looking into this after receiving a grant from the U.S. Army. On the next Insight, we'll talk about it. Also, four plans have been submitted for redevelopment of two blocks on downtown Sacramento's K Street. We'll hear about the Boca Ria plan that would create a year-round marketplace. And the history of the California State Fair explored in a new book. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Monday morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.